This is Lecture 8, delivered by Dr. Alan McRae at Biblical Theological Seminary on Isaiah, chapters 7 through 12. For today, I asked you to look at verse 5 of chapter 29 and to note the difference between it and the King James Version. That was not the main thing. The main thing was an outline of chapter 29, but I was interested to know what you would do with that. It interested me to see that what I thought was a tremendous difference, there was not one paper in 20 that even mentioned it. And practically every paper mentioned something that I hadn't even noticed. But I mean, it's an interesting difference, but it is not a vital difference. But the point I had in mind is a very vital point, and that is that in the King James Version, it starts with the word moreover. And just about any modern version you pick up, it will start with the word but. That's a tremendous difference. Because if you say, I'm going here, moreover, I will do such and such a thing when I am there, you're just going on. But if you say, I am going here, but I will not do so and so, you're making a transition. In the Hebrew, you cannot tell which it is. So that it is a case where the Hebrew can be interpreted either way. But in the light of the context, it should be clear that but or yet or something like that is correct. But first, I want to answer a question someone just asked me. Was there a difference in the time with which these two sections deal? That is the very point I'm trying to get across. That in chapters 7 to 12, Isaiah deals with a certain situation, and in chapters 28 to 35, he deals with exactly the same situation. He deals with it for different people. He's talking to a different audience, probably. He handles different details of it, and one of them may, in some regards, look further forward than the other. But in both cases, what he is dealing with is two problems. One, the problem of the continuance of the nation there, the temporary situation, and yet one of great importance. Is there anything that they can do to protect themselves in this situation? The answer is absolutely not. They're in between great powers that are much too strong for them. Such a clever scheme as Ahaz has is going to rebound to do the exact opposite of what he wants. It gets rid of minor dangers, Syria and Israel, and places a tremendous danger in front of them, Assyria. And so Ahaz's scheme is one of the big thoughts of chapter 7 and following. It will not work the way Ahaz thought it would. It brings him into tremendous danger with various Assyrian incursions into the land, reaching a great climax 30 years later with the coming of Sennacherib's army. The coming of the army which puts Jerusalem in a situation as we saw in the two historical chapters that we examined some time back. It puts Judah in a situation from which, humanly speaking, there seems to be absolutely no escape. Yet God intervenes miraculously to deliver Jerusalem and to give it another 100 years of independent existence before finally it is taken not by the Assyrians, but by an entirely different people, the Babylonians. So this great invasion of Sennacherib is, you might say, the big climax he looks forward to from the viewpoint of the security, which was topmost in Ahaz's mind. From that viewpoint, that's what he looks forward to. Nothing he can do, but God alone is going to miraculously protect him through it. Well now, there's the other aspect, which, for us, is of greater importance, and that is the house of David. David was the man after God's own heart, and God promised David that he would always have a son to sit on his throne. This is one of the very strands that come together in the great messianic predictions. Here is the leadership of the house of David in the hands of one like Ahaz, who puts no trust in God, but in his human clever schemes that don't work. God says, I'm going to replace Ahaz. He doesn't say how soon, but he does say, the house of David will not always have such leadership as Ahaz gives it. There will be a virgin born, one who will be a true representative of David, who will be God's own king, Emmanuel, God with us. So this is the second idea, the turning things over, you might say, the getting rid of Ahaz and these unworthy ones, and the coming instead of the great Messiah who is predicted in chapter 7. These are the two great aspects in these chapters. Now, the last class, before I gave the test, we looked at chapter 8, and we noticed various references to Christ in chapter 8. About half of you had, as your second question, mention all the prophecies of Christ in chapters 7 and 8. And I underlined all. And then I said, discuss each briefly. Well, very few discussed them at all, and hardly anyone listed them all. And I was disappointed in that. So I'm going to take just a minute now to quickly glance again at those predictions of Christ in chapter 7 and chapter 8. Of course, the first of them is chapter 7, verse 14, which we have discussed rather fully. Then in chapter 8, in verse 8, I pointed out that he says that the Assyrian is going to sweep on into Judah. Its outspread wings will cover the breadth of your land, O Emmanuel. So here we have the Emmanuel of chapter 7 mentioned again. And the meaning, of course, is this is Emmanuel's land, of your land, O Emmanuel. And this being Emmanuel's land, the Assyrian cannot possibly take it unless God permits it. Then I mentioned that verse 10, in most of our English translations, says, to devise your strategy, but it will be thwarted. Propose your plan, but it will not stand, for God is with us. In the NIV, there's a footnote that says, Hebrew, Emmanuel. So this statement, God is with us, could just as well be translated, for Emmanuel, for it is Emmanuel's land. So verses 8 and 10 carry on the thought of the previous chapter, with the prediction of Emmanuel, although he will not be born for another 700 years. He is from all eternity, and this is his land, and nothing will happen to it except as he chooses. Then there is another clear reference in the light of the New Testament, that is chapter 8, verses 17 to 18. I'll wait for the Lord. And that word wait could just as well be translated trust. Who is hiding his face from the house of Jacob? I will put my trust in him. Here I am, the children that the Lord has given me. We are signs and symbols in Israel from the Lord Almighty who dwells on Mount Zion. We looked at that the week before the test was given, and we noted that as it stands here, you might think it was just about Isaiah. But when you look at Hebrews 2:13, you find that both verses 17 and 18 are quoted there as the words of Christ. Of course, God is the author of the whole Bible. Jesus is God. And so you might say anything can be quoted as the words of Christ. But that certainly is not the intention of the author of Hebrews. He is definitely saying, this is Christ speaking. And therefore, we're justified in saying that in this case, Emmanuel speaks. Isaiah simply notes the words of Emmanuel. Emmanuel says, he trusts in the Lord, as Jesus said so often in his life. He trusts in the Lord, and he and the children God has given him. They are signs and symbols from the Lord. So this is Emmanuel speaking in light of what the New Testament says. The principle still is in that time. Isaiah represents Emmanuel, and he has his little group that is following him. So these are definite references, and if you refer to 7, verse 14, 8, verses 8 through 10, or 8, verses 17 and 18, I was well pleased with your second question, but I don't remember whether there were many who did mention these or at least discuss them. There were a number who did not mention some of these, but who did mention 7:14. I have no objection to your mentioning verse 14, but I would put 14 in a little different category, because verse 14 simply says that the Lord will be a sanctuary. but for both houses of Israel. He will be a stone that causes men to stumble, and a rock that makes them fall. Now in the New Testament, Romans 9, verse 33, and in 1 Peter 2, 8, Jesus is spoken of as the rock against which people stumble. So these phrases very properly are taken as describing Jesus, but they do not have as direct a relationship as other passages. They are here as far as the context is concerned. They are still simply said about the Lord Almighty, and of course, Jesus is the Lord Almighty. I think now we go back to chapter 28, and as we noticed last time, chapter 28 begins in exactly the same situation, but instead of Ahaz being the one to whom Isaiah speaks, it is the nobles of Judah. He directly addresses them in chapter 28, so we know that they are the ones to whom he is talking. So you might say, our thought centers not so much on the house of David now as on the people of Israel, the people who are God's people in that time, the people through whom he keeps alive the remembrance of his name, the people through whom he prepares the way for the coming of his son. Both in chapters 7 through 12 and 28 through 35, we have many denunciations of the sins of the people. It is really a marvel of history that this has been preserved through the ages in the Old Testament Hebrew as sacred books of the Jews. You take the books that are honored and treasured by just about any other people in the world, and everything in them will tell what a wonderful people they are, how successful they've been in everything they've tried to do. Maybe if you read between the lines, and you can see where they've made mistakes and failures occasionally, but they never stress them in their own books. At least not until very recently. It has become customary in our country in the last 30 years, instead of being like when I was a boy, all our school books told how the United States was the greatest nation in the world, and everything it had done was the best any country had ever done, like just about every country has in its writings. But in the last 30 years, it has become fashionable to take the very opposite attitude. I don't think there's ever been anything quite like that in history. The way that our young people have been conditioned to see all the flaws they can possibly find in their own country, instead of recognizing with all the little flaws it has, it certainly has stood for human liberty far beyond just about any other country in the world, and certainly has given more opportunity to individuals to develop their God-given qualities than you'll find just about anywhere else in the world. I think a few people got a sour attitude in the country about 50 or 60 years ago, but those people got good positions in colleges and who passed on their attitude to a few bright people, and they passed them on to more and more, and now we have our young people, a great many of them, brainwashed with that bad attitude toward their country. But that's going from one extreme to the other. Now, the Old Testament does not go to either extreme, or you might say it goes to both extremes, because it presents Israel as God's nation, that God has called it out and God has tremendously blessed it. But the scriptures are filled with passages of denunciation of the nation for its wickedness and its sin. Yet the Jews have treasured these books as their sacred books and as the holy books of their nation through the years. It's as the prophet predicted. They would be like a beacon on a hill. They would be definitely pointing to the fact that he worked through them and prepared the way for the coming of Christ. So in both these sections, we have many passages of denunciation that we won't spend a lot of time on in this course, but we want to look at them to some extent. Let me, with that point, mention that in chapter 7 and in chapter 8, we had some pretty strong denunciation. Then in chapter 9, you start a long passage of denunciation with chapter 9, verse 8, which runs to chapter 10, verse 4. We're not going to take a lot of time on that, but for next Friday, I'd like you to start with chapter 10, verse 5, and go to the end of the chapter. Please make a brief outline and brief statement of the principal progress of thought from chapter 10, verse 5, to the end of the chapter. That's a unified section, as you are all aware. The first four verses of chapter 10 belong with the previous chapter. But in chapter 8, it began, as we noticed, with the denunciation of the northern kingdom. Of course, that dates the chapter very definitely. There's no question this was written before 722 BC, probably 10 or 12 years before that time, because Ephraim was conquered by the Assyrians and, as a people, taken into exile. Here's a prediction of their conquest. He starts, "Woe to the drunkards of Ephraim." And then, as we noticed, at verse 7, "These also stagger from wine and wheel from strong drink." These nobles here, these people who are the leaders of Judah. Then we noticed how they refused to listen to him in chapter 28, verse 9. They object. Who is he trying to teach? To whom is he trying to explain his message? Does he think we're children? Those just taken from the breasts? And he says, "Do and do, rule on rule, here a little, there a little," as if we're little children. Then he answers, "All right, God will speak to you in a strange way. He'll speak to you with foreign lips and strange tongues. He will speak to this people." He goes on, calls them scoffers, and then says that the scheme that Ahaz and his nobles have concocted, when they say, "We've entered into a covenant with death, with the grave we've made an agreement, when the overwhelming spirit sweeps by, it cannot touch us. We've made wise our refuge and falsehood our hiding place." The Lord says, "I'm going to destroy your plan. Your covenant with death will be annulled. Your agreement with hell will not stand when the overwhelming scourge sweeps by. You'll be beaten down." Then we have the last part of the chapter. They probably were thinking of throwing him out. But they probably decided not to when they started talking about the farmer. And the way he did, they probably said, "Oh, he's a harmless fellow. Let him go on." I don't know whether that happened or whether he left the place and some people went with him and he continued his discourse outside. But the thought continues right straight on from chapter 28 to 29. It continues right on, and he has been speaking of what this is going to do with bringing the Assyrians right to them, and now he looks to the time when they will be in terrible danger from the Assyrians, when Sennacherib will invade, which is something that is so prominent in the book of Isaiah. So he says, "Woe to you, Ariel." And we noticed the word Ariel could mean Lion of God, or it could mean Hearth of God. But over in the two chapters further on that we already looked at, chapters 30 and 31, where he speaks of how God will deliver them from the Assyrian attack, he said, "Declared the Lord, and his fire is in Zion, whose furnace is in Jerusalem." That suggests that this Ariel here means the hearth of God, the place where God will work out his great plan, the place where you will see the tremendous outworking of God, where human help has absolutely reached its end. Woe to you, Ariel! Ariel, the city where David settled. Add year to year and let your cycle of festivals go on. That fits with the hearth of God, the burnt offerings, the continuing ceremonies. He says, "You're performing all these ceremonies," but he says, "What good is that going to do you? If you don't really know the Lord, what good is it going through these ceremonies? Keep them up," he says. "Yet I will harass Ariel, yet I will vex Ariel." In some translations, "I will besiege Ariel." I think that is all right. I don't know if it's quite as specific as that, but you notice that if it is, it is God who will do it. God will besiege Ariel. He doesn't say the Assyrians, but what the Assyrians do will amount to the same as if God was besieging it. That is to say, the Assyrians are in the land, have taken all the other fenced cities, all the other fortified cities of Judah. Who knows at what moment the great Assyrian army will come marching against Jerusalem, and they will tear a hole through the wall and come in and take all the people off to slavery. Who knows how soon that will come? So they were besieged for about 3 years. God was besieging them. She will mourn among men. She will be to me like an altar hearth. I will encamp against you all around. This, you know, is not the Assyrian God. God says, I will. In other words, God was putting them in a situation as if there was an army right there besieging them. The army is not right there, but representatives from that army come every now and then calling on them to surrender and telling them what's going to happen if they don't surrender. So God is encamping against them, encircling them with powers, setting up his siege works against them. They're expecting that the Assyrians will come and set up siege works at any time. Brought low, you will speak from the ground. Your speech will mumble out of the dust. Your voice will come ghost-like from the earth. Out of the dust, your speech will whisper. Then the King James says, moreover, the multitude of your strangers will be like fine dust. It gives you the impression that it continues straight on. But as you continue, it is quite obvious that in verse 5 there is a sharp change of thought, dealing with the same situation but saying that your enemies, those attacking you, are going to become like fine dust when the Lord smote them in the night, and the great bulk of them were killed or died that night, and Sennacherib had to go back to his own land to be safe. When God worked that miracle of delivering them, their enemies had become like fine dust. Now, I had not realized until I got your papers that this says enemies, where the King James says strangers. And I think that all the recent translations make it enemies. And of course, it is talking about enemies, but the actual word used is strangers. So I personally would prefer the translation for that particular word that the King James has. The word is used about 50 times in the Old Testament. In almost every one of them, in the King James, it's translated as strangers, like, beware of the strange woman. That's the same word, only in the feminine form. It is usually used of strangers who are not desirable. That is true. Of course, in this context, these strangers spoken of here are enemies. But the actual word is referring to those of whom he'd said in the chapter before, with people of a strange tongue, people of other lips. God will speak to these people. And so, this great number of people that they can't understand, that are coming with tremendous power and strength into the land, coming as a result of Ahaz's clever scheme that backfired. These will be there, a great multitude of them, but they will become like fine dust, easily blown away. So the but, instead of moreover, I think is a great improvement in all the new translations and is just as true to the original. I think the substitution of enemies, which practically all the new translations use, is not quite as accurate as if it had said aliens or foreigners or something like that. To us, strangers conveys the idea of something good, rather than the use of foreigners, which would convey more of the idea that the people of foreign speech that they can't understand, that are coming in with force and are brutalizing the land. But he says they're going to become like fine dust, the ruthless foreigners, like blown chaff, and suddenly, in an instant, the Lord Almighty will come. By the way, I'll take a second to mention, I asked you to compare one modern version to the King James. One person wrote that he compared Moffat's translation, and that Moffat left out most of the verse, so the comparison didn't amount to a great deal. However, I think he should have looked a little further into Moffat, because what Moffat does is that after verse 4, he then takes the last phrase of verse 5 and puts it right there, and then he puts verse 6, and then puts the first two parts of verse 5. So whoever used Moffat should have looked a little further, and they would have found that verse 5 was right there. I'm not recommending Moffat to you, because he's one of those who changes the scripture around to suit what he thinks the people ought to have said. At the same time, Moffat was a brilliant man and a brilliant student. While you go through the Moffat translation, you will find that if he doesn't like what's there, he'll just change it around any old way, and you can't depend anything on it. Yet every now and again he will take a line or verse that you know exactly what the Hebrew means, but how to put it in English is very difficult. Sometimes Moffat will exactly hit on a way to express the idea in English. Then, the next verse, he may give you something that has nothing to do with what is in the Hebrew. So I don't recommend it to you, but I just wish I remembered who referred to it, because I think you would be wise to look a little further on, and you would find that the verse is there in its entirety. We noticed then, starting in chapter 29, verse 5, we have a complete change. Verses 1 through 4 are the condition with Sennacherib's army, and Jerusalem realizes that they do not dare go very far from the walls. They don't know when they may meet a roaming band of Assyrians, or they might meet the whole army coming to make the expected attack on Jerusalem. So, suddenly, in an instant, the Lord Almighty will come with thunder, earthquake, and great noise, windstorm, tempest, and flames of devouring fire. Now these, of course, are figurative expressions. We don't believe that God caused thunder, earthquake, windstorm, tempest, and flames to be the means he used to destroy this Assyrian army. It seems far more likely that he used an epidemic among them, which rapidly wiped them out. Scripture says that the angel of the Lord killed them. What method the Lord used, we don't know, but it is very unlikely that it was an earthquake or windstorm. These are figurative expressions. Occasionally you hear somebody say, "I take everything in the Bible literally." Anybody who does that, I doubt if they've ever read the Bible, because you cannot take everything literally in any book that was ever written. There are always figurative expressions, and there are many very beautiful figurative expressions in the Bible. We take the Bible and we study it in light of the context of each section to see what it says. We believe what it says is true. It is without error. But to say that we take everything literally would, of course, be absurd. It has many beautiful figures of speech. These here, undoubtedly, are figures of speech. Then, the hordes of all the nations that fight against Ariel, that attack her and her fortresses and besiege her, will be as it is with a dream, with a vision in the night. As when a hungry man dreams when he is eating. Who is this hungry man? It is Sennacherib, of course. Sennacherib says in his annals, he shut up Hezekiah like a bird in its cage in his capital city. Although no Assyrian king would be proud of shutting up someone like a bird in its cage in its capital city. No Assyrian king ever says that about anybody else. They say, "His capital city I attacked, I knocked down its walls, I took a third of its people captive, and the rest of them I killed, I piled up their corpses in great heaps." That's the way the Assyrian kings speak about the capitals of many of the nations that they've conquered. But here it says, "He shut him up like a bird in its cage in its capital city." Sennacherib was like a hungry man who dreams that he is eating, but awakes and his hunger remains, meaning he has to go back to Nineveh without taking Jerusalem or without giving Hezekiah the punishment that he wanted to give him. When a thirsty man dreams, he is drinking again. These are beautiful figures of speech. You can't take them literally. Sennacherib wasn't left hungry or thirsty. I imagine that if half the army starved, he still would have had plenty. But what he wanted, to capture Jerusalem and to capture Hezekiah, had failed. He awakens with his thirst unquenched. So it will be with the hordes of all the nations that fight against Mount Zion. It says all the nations and all the nations, all the peoples, The Assyrians had conquered so many different nations, and they made them supply soldiers for their armies, and so it was a multinational army which the Assyrians directed in their great conquest, which for a period of 2 or 3 centuries terrorized most of the Middle East. So then, after giving this wonderful promise of deliverance, he then turns to rebuke these people. Be stunned and amazed. Blind yourselves and be sightless. Be drunk, but not from wine. Stagger, but not from strong drink. In other words, he says, you folks here in this banquet hall, or you who were in the banquet hall, whether this is continued an hour later or the next day or something, you were becoming drunk in your exaltation or in this wonderful scheme you and Ahaz had worked out. But he says that the time is going to come when you'll be staggering, not because of drinking, but because of the punishment of God which he's going to give you. The Lord has brought over you a deep sleep. He has sealed your eyes, the prophets. He has covered your heads, the seers. For you, this whole vision is nothing but words sealed in a scroll. And if you give the scroll to someone who can read and say to them, read this, please, he'll say, I can't. It's sealed. He won't bother to open the seal and read it. He gives an excuse. He is saying, go on in the way you're going, refusing to look at all the facts, paying all your attention to earthly things instead of looking up at God and his power. You're looking at your human schemes. You're blind to God's will, God's promise. That's what he's saying. It's sort of ironic. I would say that the true prophets, of course, God called men here and there. There was no heredity line of prophets. There was no appointment of prophets. God called on certain men to speak his word, but there were other men who claimed to be prophets. Now, a prophet could be a seer in that he was able to give and answer to problems people brought to him. He could be, but he wouldn't have to. But there were others who would claim to be. That is, that you can't make an exact line. There are the true prophets, but then there were many people claiming to have visions. We have plenty of people today claiming to be able to predict the future, most of whom you forget the mistakes they make and only remember the times they hit it right. I would say that that is definitely and exclusively a prediction of the deliverance from Sennacherib. Now, I would say that the principle involved can be carried on as an illustration. You can say that no matter what forces, what nations try to destroy God's plan, they won't succeed. Just as he delivered them, God can intervene when he chooses, with windstorms, hail, and all tremendous force as he chooses. But I would say that this is specifically a prediction about Sennacherib. That would be my feeling. The principle continues, but I don't think it's a specific pointing to some event in the more distant future. It could be, if you had those words alone in a different context, it very well could be taken as a prediction of a great future event. But when it is tied right directly with Sennacherib's invasion in the previous verses, it seems to me that we should take it as a specific prediction here. All the nations that are fighting against it. If the Assyrians had a lot of nations, people from many different nations, I would think that, yes, the Assyrians had conquered the many peoples, and they had held them in subjection, by this time, for a century or more, and from them they had drafted soldiers into their armies, so they had people from many different ethnic backgrounds in their armies. Here, then, he's rebuking these people who are like Ahaz. He rebuked Ahaz and said that he would replace them. God will send, in his own time, his own king, virgin-born. Now in chapter 29, he is rebuking the nobles, the leaders of the people. He's rebuking that large part of the nation that follows him with their lips, as he says in verse 13, honors him with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. He is here rebuking them. He says in chapters 29, verse 11 and 12, when they give excuses not to dig into his word, and find what he means and follow his truth. They're giving all kinds of excuses. Those who can read won't bother to open the seal. Those who would bother to open the seal, they say, what good is it? I can't even read. They're giving all kinds of excuses. He says, these people come near to me with their mouth, they honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. Their worship, for me, is made up only of rules taught by men. Therefore, once more, I will astound these people with wonder upon wonder. The wisdom of the wise will perish, and the intelligence of the intelligent will vanish. Here he's looking way beyond these situations. It is a parallel of the situation with Ahaz, where he looks ahead to the replacement of Ahaz to the true head of the house of David, the virgin-born Christ. Here he speaks his woe to those of the nation who are in the line of Ahaz. He says in Isaiah 29, verses 14 through 16, I will astound these people with wonder upon wonder. The wisdom of the wise will perish, the intelligence of the intelligent will vanish. Woe to those who go to great depths to hide their plans from the Lord, who do their work in darkness and think, who sees us? Who will know? You turn things upside down as if the potter were thought to be like the clay. You should be the clay in God's hands. God wants us to be instruments in his hands, to be what he wants us to be, and to serve as he wants us to serve. But these people want God to be their instrument. They're looking for God to deliver them and to do what they want, instead of seeking to find out how they can be brought in line with God's purposes. They are turning matters upside down, as if the potter were thought to be like the clay. The potter molds the clay, not the clay the potter. When you look to God to do what you want, you are trying to make him your servant. You're turning things upside down. That's what these people are doing, he says. Shall what is formed say to him who formed it, you did not make me? Can the pot say to the potter, he knows nothing? In a very short time, will not Lebanon be turned into the fertile field, and a fertile field seemed like a forest? That's Isaiah 29, verse 16. What does that mean? That means a complete turning about. Taking the forest of Lebanon, the country outside the land of Israel, the outsiders, taking them and turning them into a fertile field. Taking the fertile field, God's vineyard, which he has plowed and which he has cultivated and which is not bringing the fruit that he wants. It's going to seem like a forest. He's going to turn things upside down, just as he predicted in chapter 7 that Ahaz will be replaced by God's own king. Here he's predicting that, for a time, the people of God who have not been loyal to him, have not followed him as they should, will be replaced, and as Jesus said, the kingdom of God will be taken away from you and given to a nation that will bring forth the fruits thereof. So it is a beautiful figure outside. Lebanon, the uncultivated forest, will be turned into the fertile field, and Israel, the fertile field, is going to seem like a forest, a prediction of the change that's going to come. In that day, the deaf will hear the words of the scroll, and out of gloom and darkness, and the eyes of the blind will see. Once more the humble will rejoice in the Lord. The needy will rejoice in the Holy One of Israel. He's telling here of the replacement, for a time, of the people of God, as these who refuse to listen to him, who refuse to follow God's prophet. Therefore, verse 22 says, this is what the Lord, who redeemed Abraham, says to the house of Jacob. The Lord who redeemed Abraham. You don't exactly find that expression very much. That is not speaking of God's dealing with Israel. It is speaking of the progenitor who is brought out of a heathen land whom God called. He says, to the Lord who redeemed Abraham, says to the house of Jacob. No longer will Jacob be ashamed. No longer will his face grow pale. when he sees in his midst his children. The work of my hands, they will keep my name holy. They'll acknowledge the holiness of the Holy One of Jacob. It reminds us of what John the Baptist said in Matthew 3, verses 7 through 9. You say we're sons of Abraham. God can make sons of Abraham out of these stones. So here is Jacob, looking and seeing in his midst those who God has supernaturally brought into the people of God. It seems to me that, in this chapter, we have a parallel to Romans 11, where Paul shows the figure of the olive tree which grows up. The olive tree where the natural branches are taken out and wild branches are grafted in. I believe that is what we have here. It's just the exact parallel to the Ahaz and his ilk being replaced by the Messiah. The people of God becoming largely people like the forest of Lebanon, people outside who were previously thought to be outside the pale, being a fertile field. I wouldn't be dogmatic about verse 24, but I am inclined to think that verse 24 means the bringing back again the natural branches into the tree, which Paul predicts in Romans 11 when he says, "So all Israel shall be saved." That will be the eventual bringing back to them into the center of God's plan. We'll continue from that point next time. This has been Lecture 8, given by Dr. Alan McRae.